Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Wednesday, April 18th, 2018. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary, the 70-something odd monthly magazine of fire engines driving behind me, which I don't know if you can hear, so I'm a little distracted from my ordinary spiel. So $19.95 gets you a digital subscription, $29.95 gets you an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine in your mailbox 11 times a year. With me, as always, Abe Greenwalder, senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Noah Rothman, our associate editor. Hi, Noah.
Hello, John.
He will not be with us next week as he is going actually on vacation. Can you believe it? Noah on vacation? It's terrifying to think about. And birthday boy father, Saurabh Amari, son Maximilian, 1 year old today. Hi, Saurabh.
Oh, hi, John, and happy birthday to you too.
Oh, please stop already. So, sure. We have a lot of we're doing our podcast a day early today because there's so much going on that we figured we should jump on the news, because basically it is just a roiling pit of confusion in Trump foreign policy world with the news that Mike Pompeo, the CIA director and Secretary of State nominee, has in fact met with Kim Jong-un in the run-up to the potential summit meeting between the president of the world's most powerful country and the head of the world's most evil pipsqueak nonsense country. Real great thing that we are, you know, equalizing the two in this fashion, but okay. Pompeo is, after a contentious confirmation hearing in front of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, it appears that Pompeo is on the verge of being voted out unfavorably by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on the basis of absolutely nothing, which we'll get to. And then we have the confusion over Russian, further Russian sanctions relating to the Russia's role in the Syrian chemical weapons event in Ghouta last week, where UN Ambassador Nikki Haley effectively announced in front of the UN that we were going to impose new sanctions. And the president then apparently was watching her on TV and decided that he had never approved these sanctions and the whole thing had to be walked back. So either Nikki Haley has been embarrassed, or Donald Trump has been embarrassed, or nobody now argues that Nikki Haley got it out in front of her skis. This was clearly what everybody believed the new administration policy was, and the president either changed his mind or didn't himself understand that he had given the green light to Nikki Haley. And when he learned he had, because she announced it, he decided that he didn't want it to happen. So this is a big steaming pile of mess that steps on yet again. President with his unique ability to step on his own resolute action and in announcing the approving the strike on three Syrian chemical warfare positions Friday night. Now here we are 5 days later, and everything is just a total jumble and scramble and haze. So we bomb a country with chemical weapons and are in some odd fashion seem to be semi-sucking up to a country with nuclear weapons. That's really a fantastic parallel and analog. So where should we go? I think we should start maybe with talking about Mike Pompeo and his confirmation trouble. And Noah,
If I can circle back real quick to North Korea and what we're seeing on the ground
there. We're not going to start with Mike Pompeo.
No, because it's related to that. It's very much related to Mike Pompeo, who is the CIA director, but he is functioning at this point as a very high-level diplomat, performing some pre-game work ahead of a possible Kim-Trump summit, and summitry is not successful absent that kind of preamble. So it's a good thing. What we've heard so far from the South Korean side and the American side is what we're preparing to put on the table, which is essentially really easy stuff that's always on the table. Recognition of facts on the ground, an armistice that turns into a peace treaty, formal recognition of the DPRK, stuff like that that we can do with a pen stroke. What they're offering now, supposedly, is denuclearization of the peninsula, which is very hard. I don't think that's ever going to happen. It is their single most important chip. So then we have to talk about what might be on the sidelines of this negotiation, which I think is what Mike Pompeo is going. It went to DPRK, to Pyongyang, to discuss American hostages, Japanese captives, their long-range missile program, their export of drugs and arms, their material support for terrorism, the United States' posture on the peninsula, the extent to which our sanctions regime is going to be loosened in these negotiations. A lot of really hard stuff. So, you know, with all that hanging out in the open and we don't know how it's going to be resolved, Mike Pompeo is out there performing this groundwork, this really high-level diplomacy. And at home, he is facing really stiff opposition from members of Congress, mostly Democrats and one very outspoken Republican, who are saying he's not qualified to perform this kind of diplomatic, these kind of diplomatic overtures.
It is not clear that they're saying that he's not qualified, and calling him unqualified is itself preposterous because he's been serving as a confirmed official and head of the CIA for a year or more and has performed creditably. There are no accusations of improper behavior, improper conduct of any sort in any way in his executive branch work. He appears to be liked and well-liked by the bureaucracy at the CIA, which is the sort of thing that might cause some feelings of discomfort on the right, but not necessarily on the left because of capture by the deep state or whatever. So he's been confirmed. He served as a good confirmed official. He is nominated as Secretary of State. There are no claims that his personal behavior, his personal conduct, or his conduct as an executive branch official should take him out of consideration. So therefore, what we have here is a further step into tribal polarization in which Democrats are going to vote against a Republican nominee. To vote against a Republican nominee, he could be Mother Teresa, and they would vote against him because he is a Republican nominee. That is actually a real change. That is not normal. Generally speaking, these things have been pick-and-choose moments at which somebody who has controversy behind him or has a real history of controversy is forced to answer for it, then people say, I really can't go with that because they want to make somebody an example of. That is not the case with Pompeo. They don't like him because they don't like his ideology, and they don't like him because they want to hit Trump. And that has not been the stand. That has not, for 200 years, really been the standard by which you reject a nominee.
The rules are different for Trump. Then the question is, are they going to remain different after Trump? And is this going to be the way going forward? This reminds me, this is an amplification of sorts of that piece that was written a few months back. You'll remember by whom, because I don't, saying, but it was this was a political piece telling Americans, don't vote for Republicans ever. Be dumb. Be mindless. We have to
Jonathan
mindless.
Jonathan Rauch and Ben Wittes.
Right. Yeah. This reminds me of a sort of institutionalization of that. Be mindless. Simply punish them for their associations for of their party.
So I just want to add to John's point about Pompeo's seriousness. Not only has he served for a year as CIA director with no issues that we know of, he was long before that in the House known as a serious Republican foreign policy hand and thinker, and not a fringe character, not a crank. You may have disagreed with him, but he was thoughtful, articulate, thought about the world in serious terms. So there really is no excuse. The only substantive objections that I can tell seem to have originated shamefully from the Anti-Defamation League, which under its president, who
I don't think they originated there. They were surfaced and publicized there, but I don't
sure,
think
sure,
they,
yeah. Sure. Under Jonathan Greenblatt, who's this kind of Obama apparatchik who has now taken control of the ADL, has become a wing of the Democratic Party or an arm of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And the accusations are ridiculous. And again, it's a shame on the ADL to suggest that, you know, that he's some sort of anti-Muslim bigot. For example, they pull out a quote where he says, you know, the Islamist terrorist challenge cannot just be defined by geography or military political terms. It is a faith-driven challenge that can't be limited to just thinking about a small corner of the Middle East. And so that is something that I have said that lots of serious
people. The Obama administration has
said there's it was an ideological dimension to the challenge. It's nothing nefarious there. Or, for example, the idea, he says, there are organizations and networks here in the United States tied to radical Islam in fundamental ways, and they're not just in places like Syria. Well, that is actually true. That there was the whole controversy over the Holy Land Foundation, which
wasn't a controversy. It was found guilty of
unindicted
co-conspirator in terrorism. There was, of course, Samuel Aryan, the Florida International University professor who was deported from the United States because he was running an illegal Hamas arm in Florida. I mean, you know, there may not be many. It may not be like a grand international network. But the idea that there aren't domestic threats from extremist Islam is crazy. And then your other favorite example, I think, or maybe this is not Greenblatt, but this, I can't remember, but this accusation that Pompeo said something like, there was a radical Islamic connection to the
Boston. Diane Feinstein.
Oh, Diane said, Feinstein.
Who said?
Go ahead.
Here's what she said. Pompeo has said that American Muslims may have been complicit in the Boston Marathon bombing of 2013. That is an empirically true statement. That's a fact. The boys who did it, the Tsarnaev brothers, were American Muslim. There were American citizens who happened to be Muslim who committed this attack. That there's nothing that you could challenge.
No, is it an isolated incident? I mean, we all forget about the lone wolf attacks that occurred in that period, but a woman who was beheaded in the Midwest, an axe attack in the subway system in New York City on police officers. These guys were radicalized online.
The dumpster bombings in Chelsea, in New York,
attacking
Parliament
in Ottawa,
which followed by a shootout with cops in Patterson, New Jersey, and of course the Pulse and San Bernardino bombing. Again, not saying that this is a net where these are networked events, but the idea that the American people are completely secure and safe from domestic homegrown radical Islamic terrorism is an absurdity.
And so what would the ADL suggest now, that to suggest there's an ideological dimension to radical Islam, and in that it is, that ideological dimension is tied in some respects to the Islamic faith, maybe a perversion of the faith, but nevertheless is tied to the faith. That is now
in fact,
a red line that you can't do that?
This was an argument that Democrats used when arguing against the quote-unquote travel ban, that radical Islam is not limited to these few countries in North Africa and the Middle East that were listed in the travel ban. The Tsarnaevs came from Russia. We have a significant Middle Eastern or Muslim radicalization problem in places like Indonesia and Malaysia. So that this ban wasn't comprehensive enough. That was actually one of the smarter arguments against it.
So the ADL, again, disgraces itself in its new iteration, and that's nothing new. So the idea here is that the Democratic Party and some of its backers have decided that Mike Pompeo should not be secretary. He will become Secretary of State. The simple fact of the matter is he may be reported out unfavorably and thus be the first Secretary of State in 100 years to be reported out unfavorably from committee but get voted on the floor. But he will get voted on the floor. It will be 51-50 or 51-49 or something like that. Rand Paul, who will vote against him in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, will vote against him on the floor. No other Republican will. And if it gets too close, because John McCain can't vote on the floor because he is being currently treated for, you know, complications stemming from his brain cancer, then Mike Pence will step in as vice president and cast the tie-breaking vote. So he will be Secretary of State. The whole point about this is to send the message that nobody who is being nominated and put up for any cabinet job by Trump will get a single Democratic vote. That is new. That is new. That is new. That is new.
We should add that CIA Director Designate Gina Haspel may not fare as well as Mike Pompeo. There are more substantial frustrations with her, although the initial accusation against her was entirely unfounded and unwarranted, the notion that she was involved in rendition during the Bush era. But I don't know whether or not the jury has come back with a verdict on Haspel.
Yeah, we haven't really heard about it. I think it is fair to assume that it may well become Democratic strategy or the root Democratic approach to this, that every Democrat will vote against every Republican nominee for everything.
And then it might also become tit for tat.
Well, eventually, yeah. But I mean, so with this.
But then when Democrats are suffering from their own tactics, that will be extraordinarily untoward. rather sorted.
How can you? How dare you? How dare you? And of course, none of the identity politics rules that should that would govern in other cases govern here. Like the fact that Gina Haspel will be the first female CIA director, that won't have any purchase. And the fact that Rick Grenell, whose nomination to be ambassador of Germany has been held up for a year by it's not clear by whom or for what reason, and that he would be the first out gay Republican ambassador. That doesn't help him, because none of these things help you if you're a Republican, which I guess is, that's, Republicans don't want identity politics to play a role. So, OK, fine, they won't. But it's still pretty striking. Now we need to move on to the question of the day, which is has Nikki Haley now entered into the dark wood of, the dark night of the soul, the dark wood of Dante's Inferno, the dark time in which she is now looked at as somehow an enemy of the White House for the crime of having announced a policy that everybody in the administration except Trump seemed to think had been agreed upon at some meeting, right? So the thing about Nikki Haley, it's been interesting, is that she seems to have been operating on an independent track for the last year and a half. She sits here in New York. She is incredibly resolute and tough and strong and making strong statements daily and doing kind of amazing things at the UN. In a kind of, dare I say, neocon fashion.
This isn't Kirkpatrick.
Yeah, here. Remember, she was the governor of South Carolina with no foreign policy experience, and it seemed like she was a kind of peculiar choice, and she's come in and sort of taken the bull by the horns and done a kind of remarkable thing. And apparently Tillerson didn't like her because she, as secretaries of state, never like the UN, a talkative UN ambassador, because they feel like their turf is being, is being poached. But now we have this weirdness of her saying something that had apparently been agreed upon and then getting slapped down by Trump. And then,
it wasn't Trump. It was
Larry Kudlow.
It was Larry Kudlow.
No, in public. No, but Trump. But we got the story. The story was leaked to the New York Times that
Trump was fuming.
That we were not going to impose new sanctions on Russia. And then when someone asked Larry Kudlow, he said she seemed to be confused. And then Nikki Haley said, I'm never confused. And Kudlow apologized because he really should shut his mouth when he doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. And he still is viewing his job as though he's on CNBC commenting on the administration for which he works, which is probably why he was hired. And I like Larry. He's an old friend of mine. But, that is just like bad public servant 101, like what he thought he was doing. I don't know.
I mean, look, Nikki Haley was in a uniquely pristine position up until this point. She was in the good graces of the president and of Never Trumpers based on her policy. So on some level, something had to go wrong at some point. The problem is with Trump, once you make the leap to not having offended him to offending him, or not having irritated him to irritating him, you may be entering a whole new world.
Well, I guess we should stipulate what happened here. So, Nikki Haley, on Friday night, these strikes occurred. Earlier in the week, according to reports, everybody was agreed that there would be follow-on sanctions targeting industries in Moscow, with reciprocity on the Russian side for their association with the Assad regime. These talking points were distributed to the RNC. They're on paper. People got them. Nikki Haley repeated them on Sunday morning on a news program. And there's some discrepancy in the reports as to when Donald Trump reversed himself, whether it was before that appearance or after that appearance, depends on the account you read. But the bottom line was Nikki Haley was repeating an administration policy, and Larry Kudlow felt the need to clean up. For some reason or another, he probably shouldn't have, but he did. And then, now that we have a fully established fact that Nikki Haley wasn't in the wrong, that Donald Trump was in the wrong, and Nikki Haley is sort of out there being the totem now for saying, I was right and the president was wrong. I mean, everybody's sort of avoiding saying that it is Donald Trump and his mercurial, capricious style that is to blame here. But it's not as though this is the first time this has happened. Donald Trump, you know, he did it to Tillerson every week.
Yeah.
Virtually every week. I mean, I was just going through this for a post that I'm trying to write on this. Like, it happens all the freaking time.
Tillerson in particular was like the sticking post. But look, by the way, Nikki Haley's friends and people who admire Nikki Haley are doing her no favor. There are people who are doing her no favors in public by saying things like, boy, she would be really great if she ran in 2020 against Trump. And there's this the one detail in the New York Times story today or yesterday that
paragraph
says
24
that you counted. No, it counted, which it says Republicans close to the White House whisper that Pence and Haley might make a great anti-Trump ticket in 2020. Well, that's just like...
Well, not anti-Trump. Why don't they just, it would be that Trump is no longer a viable option.
So they just like, why don't you just paint a giant target on both of their foreheads?
Right. Well, you had a theory that was the whole point of the exercise.
Right, yeah, right. It was dropping a dirty dime. Right, exactly, to make Trump uncomfortable and suspicious. I mean, nobody is safe, obviously, in the Trump administration, but... clearly, I think it would be an act of, you know, sort of a self-destructive act, purposeless self-destructive act for Trump to take revenge against Nikki Haley. The weirdness is that there are some people out there, like Steve Schmidt and others, who are like saying Nikki Haley needs to resign because Trump humiliated her, and that also strikes me.
No, there's no discretion there. They would prefer to have an administration that is wholly evil so that it could be painted as wholly evil.
And the other thing about it is that it's Trump's prerogative to change his mind. It's sloppy. It's extremely sloppy, and it makes people look bad and all of that. But, you know, he is the ultimate policymaker. Now, if you lose a policy fight, you can resign. It strikes me this isn't like an elemental policy fight, whether or not there should be follow-on sanctions on Russian companies to punish them for the serious strike seems to me like it's sound good policy, but it's not like you lose the fight that forces you to resign.
So, but I have so many questions about what the Democratic approach here is, because it seems so remarkably contradictory. At the one, it's a digression slightly, but I'll get back to the main point. On the one hand, you have Democrats who are saying that we wouldn't approve strikes ever because there's no coherent policy here, and also we should be accepting more refugees from the Assad regime because they're being killed by weapons of not mass destruction, but conventional weapons, which suggests that would just really, make this regime, reward this regime for its current tactics if you were just absorbing these people that they're trying to kill anyway. And second, that the administration's approach to Russia is now verging on hawkish to the point of dangerous. Like, we're getting close to the point where this administration was, according to reports, according to Donald Trump, interested in a more expansive strike that would have targeted Moscow's positions and Iran's positions as well, which, by the way, Israel is doing.
Meaning their actual physical military positions in Syria, not their political policy positions.
So what I understand from this report, and I've been reading a lot, and a lot of them are contradictory, so bear with me. The president wanted an expansive strike. He was warned that would be a dangerous escalation, decided against it. And once he saw Moscow's response was to stand down and not attack American assets or missiles in flight, that this led to the decision to ease off Moscow in the sanctions. And Moscow, according to Bloomberg, has responded favorably, saying this is another opening. We're going to look for some sort of a diplomatic overture here. The American embassy in Moscow received something to the effect that they were looking for another diplomatic opening, and they didn't respond with the reciprocal sanctions. So this might be another opportunity to say, you know, Donald Trump is colluding with Russia again, because this whole effort that was going to be put in place over the weekend just didn't materialize.
Once again, their position is so bizarre. This is happy talk, from my view, because if you really think that there was a considered, we did this, Russia did that, so we pull back on this because maybe they'll respond to that, that's normal diplomacy. We don't have normal diplomacy going on in this country. But I think the actual Democratic perspective or liberal perspective is hopelessness. That is, it's stated hopelessness. We've lost in Syria. It's all over. Anything we do just makes everything worse. So we shouldn't do anything except let refugees in. That's I think, basically. But it's shameful that we don't let refugees in, but we can't do anything else. So that may even in some deep spiritual fundamental sense be true, but as a matter of counter policy, to say, look, we're just throwing our hands up.
No, refugee policy is not defense policy. It's not foreign policy. Refugee policy is a separate matter, and I think, by the way, there's a perfectly reasonable case to be made, given the experience that Syria's neighbors have had, and especially Europeans have had with having to absorb more than 1 million Syrians, that it makes a lot more sense to try to contain the fire in Syria and stabilize it and protect civilians than to just have an open-ended exodus of essentially most of Syria's population out of Syria, including into the U.S. For all sorts of security and social cohesion reasons, that's not worked well for Europe. It's been destabilizing for European politics. You can't just say we'll fix Syria by bringing all the Syrians over here.
No, it hastens the process that the Assad regime is trying to do.
No, but the other thing is that the Democratic line is Trump is wow, this is great. He's bombing Syria, but you know, look at the reduced number of refugees we let into the United States. It's true, and I think it's bad. I'm not in bed. And I think the argument was made very strongly that there is that the clearance process for Syrian refugees was already pretty tough. And that the notion that you needed to tighten it still further simply to fulfill some idiot campaign promise, you know, for yahoos who hate people who speak, you know, Arabic. That's not my idea of a good policy, but the simple fact of the matter is even in the loosest Obama policy, 15,000 people were coming in. 15,000, you know, that in a year, 15,000. Like, that's not going to solve the from Syria. That's not going to solve the problem of Syria. And using that as some counterweight to. But the thing is, look, this is where we get to the problem of having serious conversations about this. We're trying to figure out where things should go, right? So here's how our friends, on the liberal left do, which is. Trump says we're going to pull out of Syria, and they scream. Trump bombs Syria, and they scream. Trump does this, and they say it's bad. Trump does that, and that's also bad. He does this, and it's opposite, and nothing, everything is the same simply because he touches it. Now, that's a wonderful, magical way to look at life, is to say anything Trump does is bad, so we will oppose it, even if it's something that it seemed like we would have agreed with 2 weeks ago. But, you know, he is the president of the United States. Republicans run the House. We have to get through the next 3 years. Like, that's all well and good. And maybe it pushes and stimulates pushes the buttons of their followers and everything like that. But at some point, it's fundamentally unserious about the most serious things. Like, you know, these are matters of life and death and great power struggles, yeah. And Europe's future as a continent that can do good
well,
for the world?
Those on the left have definitely seized upon the sanction reversals as evidence of, as fresh evidence of the collusion narrative. But I would point to something else that we've touched on during this podcast in response to that, which is, if you're looking to figure out why Trump would speak well of or look forward to partnerships with bad regimes. Look at what he now has going on with North Korea. Look how he is elevating Kim Jong-un's standing in the world. I mean, this is a guy who Trump does not pay particular attention to the dangerous evils of bad regimes. That's not foremost in his mind when dealing with these problems.
Actually, you could call it a realist perspective, even though it's just kind of ad hoc. But it's the kind of perspective that Democrats have been arguing for the better part of my political maturity, which was, you know, the overly ideological foreign policy was dangerous.
Right. But, I mean, look, what Kim has gotten out of him is, you know, Putin, you know, that's been the most remarkable thing.
Well, we don't know. We'll see what Kim gets or doesn't get out of him.
But even the pretense, even the meeting.
Yeah, look, the meeting alone is a concession.
Yeah.
Look, the whole point about Trump before he became president is that he said everybody else is an idiot. Everybody, all deals are bad, and your deal is bad in this way because if I were the one making the deal, I would make a good deal because I only make good deals and they only make bad deals and all this. So this is his deal. Yeah. North Korea is his deal. This is the deal where he's supposed to make a deal that will show how the deal works, and it's the art of the deal, the comeback.
It's too good to pass up for him. Yeah.
Well, it isn't too good to pass up. He decided that this would be the deal, and that simply the fact that North Korea wants to talk to him is already being seen as some kind of a weird victory lap. Well, of course it wants to talk to him. Of course Kim Jong-un wants
prestige.
To sit across. Immense prestige.
It's been seeking a bilateral meeting for the better part of 25 years.
I mean, the last time an American met with Kim Jong-un that we know of, let's say, was Madeleine Albright in 2000 when she was Secretary of State. They had a meeting with his father.
Clapper went to Pyongyang in 2014.
But I don't think he met with him. He did the last official American meeting with was the Secretary of State with the head of the regime. And that was very pointed because that's high but not high enough. And, you know, in the pecking order of the world, he's about at the Secretary of State level. That would have been the thought. So now he's got a nuclear weapon. Now he's firing nuclear weapons at us. So now he's going to be treated like, Mr. Summit, like a person that we should be having summits with. Well, whom does that embolden? We don't even know. I mean, you know,
we can
guess. Molly, you know, whatever. Ridiculous. I'm just picking a name off, French Guiana, develop a nuclear weapon just so they can, be invited to the big show. I mean, that's the danger of treating a nation that claims to be a nuclear proliferator as though its emergence as part of the nuclear club gives it special status and standing as opposed to makes it a worse pariah. So I don't know. Okay, so if we move on quickly, we can go on to the craziness surrounding Trump lawyer Michael Cohen and everything that is going on with Michael Cohen and the court and the documents and... nobody understands what happened in the courtroom on Monday when he sought to have the documents that were seized from his office, his home, and his hotel room under attorney-client privilege. That was denied. And then, for reasons that are almost inexplicable, it became necessary for the court to order that his third client be named, aside from Elliot Brody and President Trump, and the answer of this third client was that it was Fox News host Sean Hannity, which has now been 3 days in headlines, and nobody knows what it means, and it doesn't matter, whose business it is. Mike Mukasey has a terrific piece, I thought, in the Wall Street Journal today saying that, Andy McCarthy has a piece in which he says that it is an outrage that Hannity was named because... if there is attorney-client privilege attaches not to the attorney, but to the client. So ruling that the client had to be named, as Judge Kimball Wood did on Monday, is an offense to Hannity. It has nothing to do with Cohen. She did not have the right to surface Hannity's name if Hannity were to claim privilege. Now, he wasn't in a position to claim or not claim privilege. And one of the weird things that's gone on with Hannity is first he said he wasn't his lawyer, and then he said he was, and then he said he wasn't, and then he said he was, then he said he paid him $10, but then he said he wasn't his lawyer, but he deserves privilege, but he doesn't. So who the hell knows what's going on there? The main thing I want to ask you guys about is how does this seems to have ignited a new hope among those who think that Trump can simply disappear, somehow vanish from the scene the way President Lindbergh vanishes from the scene in The Plot Against America by Philip Roth by flying his plane into the clouds and never emerging, somehow Trump will disappear, and this is the new thing that is going to make Trump disappear. Are you sensing that as well?
Well, I mean, yeah, but it's only the latest example, like you said, of this sort of ex machina that people hope Democrats hope will result in some sort of a rehash of 2016 and a more favorable outcome. There should be, and I get the impression that there's some mechanism that they believe will rid us of Donald Trump, and legitimately so, because the public And it goes back to 2016. I mean, we're getting a little far afield here, but it goes back to the fact that they don't believe 2016 was a legitimate election, that people were influenced unduly by outside elements, and therefore the president is illegitimate. And they believe he should, and everybody associated with him should be treated like they're illegitimate. Now, there are some very real legal issues here with Mr. Cohen and his behavior and why this Southern District approved of a warrant to raid his premises, and what they saw in that warrant suggests something very real happened here. But I can't, no matter the worst case scenario, I cannot get from point A to impeachment and removal.
I think that Andy McCarthy in a separate piece pointed out that Cohen could be in a great deal of trouble. But I think it's an open question whether Trump himself. The thing that I keep imagining is, okay, they ruffle through those files and they find what? That Trump is even more lecherous, even more unfaithful to his wife, even kinkier in sexual matters and blah, 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 than we already think he is.
Or was
he
aware of a payoff.
Okay, it's now time for my Aaron speculation moment. I'm going to do the Aaron speculation. We talked about this before the show, so everybody is briefed on it here, and they all like it. And it's total Aaron speculation. So are we going to – we have a bullet and it's Aaron speculation. I'm going to say this every minute. Here's my Aaron speculation. What's going on with Cohen? Okay. I take from the interesting change in tone and behavior of Stephanie Clifford, a.k.a. Stormy Daniels, and her lawyer, Michael Avenatti, that their target has moved from Trump to Michael Cohen. Avenatti wants to get Cohen. He said he's radioactive. Anybody who's near him should get away because he's going to poison them. And in 60 days, Cohen will fall like a redwood. And I don't know what he said, like crazy hysterical
hashtags.
Stuff.
Hashtags. A lot of hashtags.
Right. Okay, so why is Cohen the villain? I thought Trump was the issue here. Trump's payoff. Trump this, Trump that. This is about Trump and his behavior and Trump sending the very sketchy sketch of the guy in 2011 to... you know, threaten her in a parking lot, the sketch that looks eerily like her actual husband, Stormy Daniels' husband, if you look at it. Or it looks like Tom Brady, or it looks like John Bon Jovi, or it looks like Johnny Damon. But it mostly looks like her husband. So, anyway.
You got Willem Dafoe.
Or Willem Dafoe. Okay, so now we got five or six people, including her husband. Okay, so I have a theory, and we're now in the air in speculation. So we know that they've been looking into him for months. And we know that Stormy Daniels was paid into Cohen for months. We know that Stormy Daniels was paid $130,000 by Trump. We know that Elliot Brody, his other client, was paid someone $1.6 million to hush up an affair and an abortion. And we know that the National Enquirer, in a deal that was somehow in which Cohen was involved, paid
Karen McDougal.
Karen McDougal.
Apologies to Caitlin O'Donnell.
Yes, I apologize to everyone in America named Caitlin O'Donnell. So I will tell you very quickly that, you know, on radio shows, like they used to have a thing, Fred Allen invented a couple of characters on his radio show, and people started writing letters saying, I'm that person. So they ended up having to name them things like Socrates Mulligan and stuff like that, so there would be no one with that name. Anyway, so Ms. O'Donnell. McDougal. Anyway, so she gets $150,000 from the National Enquirer, which pays it and then buries the story, right? Okay. So Cohen is the lawyer in all these cases. And there's another lawyer in all these cases. Same lawyer. His name is...
Davidson.
Keith Davidson. And Keith Davidson... is one hell of a piece of work, and you should Google him if you really want to find out about him. But he seems to basically represent showbiz garbage. I don't know how else to describe it. Like showbiz, the dregs of show business in some fashion or other, including he went to Hulk Hogan to try to sell Hulk Hogan the sex tape whose existence led Hulk Hogan to sue Gawker and then drive Gawker out of business. He was peddling the sex tape back to Hulk Hogan, saying, if you pay me $300,000, I will give the two X10 copies to you and see that they are destroyed. Okay.
They're like he's a sex tape connoisseur.
That was somebody else. So there was apparently a sex tape of Mini-Me from the Austin Powers that he sold to a... to a private collector. You know how they're like private collectors of, you know,
African
Modigliani. Yeah, it was African. Yeah, so this is the private tape collector of mini me porn.
Even apparently. Talking about this, we're developing a film.
It's really terrible. Us. Okay, so this is Keith Davidson. And he is apparently he is always the lawyer in these three cases. He was the lawyer for the people involved on the other side. So I say to myself in my errantly speculative way, what the hell is going on here? And what is it that they're looking into Cohen for? And then I wonder if one of the things that Mueller found in some weird fashion or then referred to the Southern District of New York is... because we now know that this apparently has been going on for months and that the Southern District of New York actually scraped Cohen's emails already, is that Stormy Daniels was convinced by Michael Avenatti that she got a really bum deal by only getting $130,000 from Michael Cohen, and that maybe the only reason she accepted $130,000 was that her own lawyer, Keith Davidson, said, that's all they're going to pay you. And if Keith Davidson and Michael Cohen are people who work together, maybe something is going on there that suggests that there was some form of collusion and that Michael Cohen, you know, like somehow corruptly influenced in some fashion the deal. Some errant speculation. I have no idea. I'm just saying there is some weirdness there with the turn of the Stormy Daniels team again, making Michael Cohen the main villain here.
So just to offer, I mean, I think that's plausible. The alternative could be that there's word in Hollywood that when you're up in one of these cases, the guy to get is Keith Davidson. He'll, you know, like, oh, you need a guy to negotiate with, yeah, with the Inquirer? There's call up Davidson. That's the other possibility, but that, right, you know.
Or not. And, of course, Davidson isn't named in anything, and there's no, right, from what we know. And we all, I'm just saying that the oddity here is that throughout the years, there was some kind of counterparty thing between Cohen and Davidson, and Stormy Daniels is really mad at Cohen, and Stormy Daniels' lawyer is really mad at Cohen and seems way madder at Cohen than at Trump.
Yeah, I'd add also, in all of these agreements in which the two are a party to, they sort of follow the same format. They use the same pseudonyms,
yeah,
for the parties
David
involved.
David Dennison and, yeah, Peggy Peterson, or
right,
something,
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
I just want to know, Noah already said this sort of, but that there's a film gathering over our skin as we talk about this, is how unbelievably depressing it is that the White House and presidency are bound up with essentially these bottom feeders. These are sort of the lowest of the low kind of legal entertainment world.
Again. Yeah, but so, Rab, why do you like Hillary so much?
Yeah.
Are you really, yeah, going to, how much worse off would, yeah, we be?
And I think, again, I mean, you know, it is Mencken. You know, the American people will get what they want and they'll get it good and hard. I mean, Trump's character was revealed to everybody by the Access Hollywood tape, and it was decided that was insufficient reason to allow Hillary to become president. That's the simple fact of the matter is, and now we're getting it good and hard. Right. And how we restore dignity to the White House and some appropriate sense of limits to American politics and all of that, while at the same time reaping some of the benefits of this, the chaos of this presidency that is leading to a certain amount, some kind of creative destruction in Schumpeterian terms, like what appears to be a massive job stimulus that is going on from the tax cuts, you know, lowest unemployment rate, least number of, you know, job searches in 40 years, something like that. You know, but at the same time, we're sitting here and we're talking about porn stars and the president and weird lawyers and the raids of offices and all of that.
I think we should add, we've established that it's speculation. But if the speculation is correct, and then if we further speculate, if Trump was aware of this game that was being played, that might have been, that we're speculating could have been, might have been played between Cohen and Davidson, this could then be a legitimately big legal problem for Trump.
Well, so the idea you'd have to grasp is best expressed in the great screenplay to the movie Sweet Smell of Success, written by Ernest Lehman and Clifford Odets, when J.J. Hunsaker, the evil columnist who is trying to get something, he's trying to break up his sister and this jazz musician, and he sets this weaselly press agent to do it, and the press agent says, "Why are you making me do this?" And he says, "My right hand hasn't known what my left hand has been doing for 30 years. And this is Trump's defense is going to be, Cohen did things and I didn't know about them. And Cohen's defense of him will be, I didn't have to tell him because I was there to make things clean. And if he didn't know, then that was, and so in this setting, Cohen would be Sidney Falco.
Right.
And Trump is J.J. Hunsaker. Well, he is the motive force behind the corruption, but he doesn't know necessarily what it is.
So before I went to law school, a movie came out called Michael Clayton. And it's Clooney playing a kind of shady law firm fixer. Yeah. And weirdly enough, I thought, I kind of like that grind. Like, I actually, you know what? I want to. When I grow up, I want to
Michael Clayton.
And of course, it was a ridiculous thought, but just the world of fixers, it's just so unbelievably filthy. I don't know how else to say it.
But I mean, these are themes we've touched on for a long time. It has to be noted now that Ms. Daniels has been in the news for 3 months. Avenatti's been all over cable news. Now with the introduction of Sean Hannity to it, there is some sort of a cable news feedback loop that is 100% focused on this issue. And all the while, Donald Trump's job approval is going up. The GOP ballot is shrinking.
Little bit.
The intensity gap is shrinking between Republicans and Democrats. And I don't know if that's going to hold until November, but that's beside the point. The point is that it is not having an impact on this president. And the focus has been very significant, at least on cable news, which is a small environment, but nevertheless an arbiter of this sort of thing. And so you have to wonder whether or not, really, if Michael Cohen faces something that we think is probably most likely the most significant charge here, which would be campaign finance fraud in the form of this $130,000 contribution to his campaign that was not disclosed, the payoff for Stormy Daniels. As we said earlier, former Attorney General Mike Mukasey makes a pretty good point in a Wall Street Journal column today that it's not going to be that big a deal. It was the sort of thing that Barack Obama faced. He's had $2 million worth of foreign donations. His own Justice Department adjudicated the issue. They had to pay a fine, beginning, middle, end of the story. The talking point is already baked in that this is not a giant deal, that this is Barack Obama part two, and we shouldn't treat it any differently. I'm not convinced that this is going to be the world-ending situation for the Trump administration that Democrats seem to have convinced themselves it might be.
No, it's not. Because
or even a politically harmful
situation.
It's all
baked in the cake. Now, I want to make the counter case against the shrinking this and the shrinking that and Trump's approval going up. So Trump's approval is around 42. At this point in 2010, Barack Obama was at 48. The generic ballot advantage for Democrats is the average is around 7%. At this point in 2010, it was close to even. So the fact of the matter is that Democrats were in a much better position with these pieces of evidence, and Republicans white won 63 seats of the House. Now, the difference is, of course, that we have an economic boom going on here, it appears, and that was not the case in 2010, though we did emerge from, you know, the worst recession ever. But remember, Obama tried to tout that it was recovery summer, and it wasn't really recovery summer. We grew, you know, I don't know, 2.1% or something. So that really didn't help him very much. But the fundamentals still don't look good. Democrats, individual Democratic races are outraising Republicans at a bizarre clip. I think there are something like 80 Democrats who have raised more than the Republicans running in their district, and only 16 Republicans have raised more than the Democrats running in their district. Cook Political Report has just shifted 11 House seats more in Democratic favor this week. So, but I think the whole point is if Trump is baked in the cake, if his, you know, what people don't like about him is baked in the cake, it's baked in the cake. That means, you know, he can get up to 42, but he can't get higher. He can, you know, maybe what happens is that the people who sort of liked him and then decide they didn't like him, so they come back and they say he's okay. But he's not getting anybody else. That's the big question. And so if they keep rehearsing and throwing stuff at him, that should stay pretty much where it is. They just keep reminding people that what it is they don't like about him. Just as they then remind Republicans why Republicans need to be stalwart in his defense because of his enemies. That said, Trump's not on the ballot in 2018, and the idea that you drive people to the ballot to make a cast a symbolic vote for Trump against Democrats in individual races, that has not been a good horse to ride for the incumbent party or the party in power in the past. And if that changes now, it will be a change. But as we say, you never know if things change. So with that, thank you very much for listening. Noah will not be here next week, so we will try to figure out how to tape this damn thing and have it for you appropriately. Maybe good, maybe bad.
You have backups and redundancies. You'll be fine.
Oh, yeah.
Do it.
Absolutely. So for Abe Greenwald, Noah Rothman, and Saurabh Amari, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.